Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're live at the annual OSU Rally for Wellness at the beautiful Recreation and Physical Activity Center on campus. This is a very busy place with nearly 100 health and wellness-related exhibitors and professionals offering everything from biometric screenings to chair massages, osteoporosis and skin cancer screenings, and samples of delicious, healthy food. If you're on campus today, you should check it out. For more information, go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. We are surrounded by all sorts of organizations devoted to health and wellness. There couldn't be a better time to talk about the campus-wide smoking ban that will begin August 21st in earnest, I guess, when classes resume next week at Ohio State University. This is not the first campus-wide ban. 16 public and private schools in Ohio already banned smoking on parts or all of their campuses, but this is arguably the largest campus to go smoke-free. And when we say smoke-free, we mean everywhere, every nook and cranny, at least in theory. Joining me now by phone from New York to offer a critique, perhaps, or a level of critique of smoking bans is Ronald Bayer, professor at the Center for the History and Ethics of Public Health, Columbia University. His empirical research has focused on AIDS, tuberculosis, illegal drugs, and tobacco. Welcome to the show.
Nice to talk to you.
Also with us is Dr. Peter Shields. He's deputy director of the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center and co-chair of the tobacco-free implementation team at OSU. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Question for our listeners. Are you a smoker who works at or attends OSU? How will you adjust to the new smoking ban? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page and tell us what you think. Ronald Bayer, California leads the country in park and beach smoking bans. In fact, the first recorded outdoor smoking ban was in California in 1975. So there's been plenty of time to study the benefits of such a ban. What have you learned in your research about the effectiveness of smoking bans? What do they achieve?
Well, I mean, what they seek to achieve is to protect non-smokers from being exposed to side stream smoke, which is viewed as a toxin. They seek to clear the beaches of litter. And those are the main reasons that are typically given across the country when such bans are enforced. And there's a third, actually. There's some concern that cigarette butts washed into the sea, then swallowed by fish or birds, become a toxic product that can kill wildlife, the way in which plastic wrap can often have negative impacts on wildlife. What's interesting is that the evidence for side stream smoke or secondhand smoke in open air settings like beaches and parks is extremely weak. I'm not a scientist. I'm a political scientist, an historian. I study ethics. And as I began to examine the arguments given for such bans, I was really struck by the extent to which statements about the hazards of smoking in parks and beaches for non-smokers was really, simply overstated. The editor of one of the most prominent international tobacco control journals, an academic research journal called Tobacco Control, an Australian named Simon Chapman, examined the evidence for the Australian government and used the very strong language. He said the evidence for risks from side stream smoke in such settings was flimsy. And when I spoke off the record to leaders of some of the leading national tobacco control organizations and asked why they hadn't weighed in directly on these battles, although the local affiliates had, I was told quite frankly they didn't think the evidence was there. They had bigger fish to fry. It was more important to raise the taxes on cigarettes, more important to get indoor smoking bans in place and enforced, and that they saw the outdoor bans as really a sideshow. Now, I just want to add one thing. Sometimes when I make this argument, I'm confused with an apologist for the tobacco industry or for the for the hospitality industry. It's not at all the case. I'm a strong public health advocate of tobacco control. I think raising taxes on cigarettes is a hugely important intervention. I think protecting non-smokers in indoor settings is hugely important. And I think we Americans are really hamstrung by a Supreme Court that refuses to allow us to use really aggressive anti-smoking cigarette packaging approaches. So I am an advocate of tobacco control, but I think it's a huge mistake when public health officials overstate the evidence. If they want to ban smoking at Ohio State or on the beaches of California or in the parks of New York, and they say we're doing this to make it more difficult for people to smoke, we're trying to protect smokers from a habit that is going to kill them, fine. Make that argument, defend it, argue it, but don't pretend. It seems to me there's an element of pretense in saying we're doing this in order to protect all of those non-smokers whose lives are put at risk.
Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are broadcasting live from the OSU Rally for Wellness at the beautiful Recreation and Physical Activity Center right here on campus. We're talking about the smoking ban, the campus-wide smoking ban that will take effect next week and in earnest by January. If you're a OSU employee or student and you're a smoker and you want to talk about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ronald Bayer, what does ethics have to do with the issue of smoking bans?
Well, I mean, it seems to me in public health in general, one of the big questions is how far can government go in restricting our behavior, our choices, when those behaviors or choices impose hazards, not only on others. That's simple. If I swing my arms and hit you in the nose, there's no question someone can stop me. But the question is, are there times when government should be able to regulate what we do to ourselves in the name of public health? And technically, or sometimes not so technically, it's called paternalism. In common parlance, it's called the nanny state. I think we need a nanny state sometimes. I think the effort in New York to ban oversized drinks because of calories was an important, though failed, move. So the ethics here really is twofold. Can the government, in the name of protecting us from our own bad habits, intrude on our choices, number one? And how should the government, what is the responsibility of government to regulate corporations that put our lives at risk? And that, it seems to me, is a question of justice. So I don't think you can talk about public health without talking about the ethical issues, the ethical imperatives. The issue, by the way, becomes really quite important in the context of tobacco smoking, because increasingly tobacco smoking is a behavior of poor people, of people at the lower end of the economic social stratification system. So poor people, people with less education, are the ones who smoke. They're the ones who get sick. And they're the ones, I mean, think of what it's going to mean to janitors, to secretaries at Ohio State University who are addicted to or who like to smoke. Are they going to be prohibited from smoking any place? I think what's going to happen is they're going to begin to buy electronic cigarettes.
Dr. Peter Shields, what will happen to those people at OSU once the ban goes into effect?
Well, the policy is that they're not allowed to smoke anywhere on campus. That also includes not only our lower paid staff and workers, but it includes visitors and contractors. You can't smoke in garages. You can't smoke in the cars in the garages. If it's on a street, that's OSU. You can't smoke on the street or outdoors. And so people are going to have to make choices. What we do know is that doing these sort of bans, it's not about trying to protect individuals from secondhand smoke, although that's listed as one reason, and agree that the evidence for that is weak because it's something that's virtually impossible to study and segregate out from other exposures to tobacco, but importantly, we're promoting a healthy environment. So we're sending a message to folks that this is now another reason for you to quit and get healthy, and as important to our students who are interested in coming to OSU, to send a message to them that Smoking is not okay. Tobacco use is not okay. It's bad for your health, and we want to help people be as healthy as possible, encourage people to quit and that sort of thing. So we hope happens, and what's happened at many other universities is that more people quit, and smokers are pretty smart people like everyone else, and they figure out how to adapt, and they go to places where they can't smoke off campus. We're trying very hard to prevent smokers from going off campus to local neighborhoods. But they'll figure it out, just like they figured it out from not smoking in restaurants and bars.
If you happen to work in the center of campus, you have a pretty long hike. I happen to work on the edge of campus, not so much. What about that, Professor Bayer? Why not send a message with these kinds of policies?
Organizations
do it all the time.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think the real the important thing about public bans on smoking is the process of denormalizing smoking. It used to be cool to smoke. It used to be something normal. It used to be something social. And as a colleague and friend of mine, Alan Brandt, once wrote, smoking, you know, smokers have no place left to hide. And he actually has written one of the great books on the history of tobacco smoking in the United States. The other thing that's interesting is he asked the question, and I think it's interesting to ask, how did it ever happen that an aroma, kind of a smell that we kind of liked or it seemed benign, how did an aroma become a stink? The tobacco didn't change smell.
Well, I suppose I like frying onions, but if I'm inundated with them, they aren't as pleasant, right?
Oh, I agree. But the question about outdoor bans is, are people really going to be inundated? And I think the policy, as articulated just now on your show, of trying to create a so-called healthy environment, an environment that discourages smoking, is a perfectly legitimate public health strategy. What I'm concerned about is the extent to which other justifications have been used as a way of avoiding the taint of Big Brother or the nanny state. And I think public health runs a huge risk when it does that, because then people will challenge everything public health does. As your evidence stinks, you use the evidence as you see fit, and you're not leveling with us. I think if Ohio State wants to say we're a smoke-free environment and our primary purpose in a smoke-free environment is to make sure that no one begins to smoke, we make it more difficult for people to smoke because we want to help them, and we will help them. I don't know what's going to happen in Ohio State for employees. Will the university provide smoke cessation programs to help people? Will it pay for the patch? Will it pay for other harm reduction strategies? That's crucial, because for a worker who has to walk 10 or 15 minutes to get his, I mean, first of all, it's a cost to the employer. You know, men and women walking off the job to have a cigarette and taking 10 or 15 minutes to do that, it's not pleasant. I wonder why a decision was not taken to create smoking areas where people wouldn't be so inconvenienced, at least as a transition, so that the burden on current smokers wasn't so heavy.
We are going to be talking about that in a little while. First, I want to take a call from Jim in Columbus. You're on the air, Jim. You oppose the smoking ban?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. But I agree. Smoking is nasty. You know, it stinks. It's bad for your health. But I don't understand why they got to attack the smokers.
Why because they're the ones that are causing the smell? what do you mean you don't understand why they have to ban the smokers?
Well, I can remember growing up, my parents smoked, my grandparents smoked. It was there was an ashtray on the corner on that at the end of every aisle at the nearest grocery store. Hmm. You know, it was like I quit smoking, but it was in your face growing up as a kid and junior high school. Teachers smoked. You could smell it in the hallway, but it feels like they're coming. You know, everybody's going after the smoker instead of, you know, educating them.
Okay.
That's what it feels like to me. That's all I had to say, you know.
All right.
And it's like this when they voted here in Ohio, what, 8 years ago to make it, you know,
overwhelming
Republic.
Yes.
It was all non-smokers. You know, there's more non-smokers in this state than there is smokers. So that was bringing a gun to a fistfight. Or, you know, the smokers had no chance. The government, personally, they wanted the revenue. That's why they never did or said a thing about it till here recently in the last decade or so, a couple decades. So.
And boy, have they changed their tune. Jim, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it. Dr. Peter Shields, does it feel, I mean, well, let's take a quick break and then we can get into more of these issues. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're live at the annual OSU Rally for Wellness at the Recreation and Physical Activity Center on campus. This is a very busy place. Nearly 100 health and wellness-related exhibitors and professionals offering all sorts of services and information. If you're on campus today, you should check it out. For more information, go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. We're talking about smoking bans today. Next week, OSU begins its campus-wide ban. Still with us, Ronald Baer. He is He is professor at the Center for the History and Ethics of Public Health at Columbia University. Also with us, Dr. Peter Shields is deputy director of the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center and co-chair of the tobacco-free implementation team at OSU. Dr. Baer, any parting thoughts? I mean, isn't the whole idea that you want to denormalize smoking, that it's a major public health threat, and that as long as it's considered normal, not necessarily ashtrays at the end of the grocery store aisle, but all things being equal, considered normal, that they'll continue to be smokers, and that is a cost. There's a cost to that.
I believe that the most important thing we're engaged in right now is trying to shift a culture that emerged over the last century that it included a habit, a behavior that we know is toxic. This is a huge, huge struggle, and the question of how we achieve that is going to be test our sense of what the private domain is, what the public domain is. We will have to ask ourselves questions about, do people have a right to take risks with their own lives? And I think those are important questions in a democratic society, and I think we should address them directly. I'm pleased to hear that at Ohio State that the issue was not the focus on those blue rings of smoke hurting others, but the blue rings seducing. And I think it's admirable. I think it's a model for the way the discussion ought to go forward. I actually remember the commissioner of health in one major metropolitan area saying the thing that's most important to him is that children be allowed to be at a park or beach without seeing someone smoke. That's an amazing thing to say, because it wasn't that the kids should not be exposed to smoke as a toxin, but rather they shouldn't see this behavior. Whether we consider that overly paternalistic or nannyism or whatever, I am surprised. I don't know how easy it was to achieve what you did at Ohio State, and whether there was much pushback from people who said, it's my right to do what I want. I don't know what the law is in Ohio about motorcycle helmets, for example. I applaud what Ohio State has done.
Okay. Professor Baer, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ronald Baer is a professor at the Center for the History and Ethics of Public Health at Columbia University. Once again, still with us, Dr. Peter Shields of the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center, where he's deputy director. He's also co-chair of the tobacco-free implementation team at OSU. And joining us now, Professor Micah Berman. He holds a joint appointment with the OSU Moritz College of Law and the College of Public Health. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Micah Berman has done research on the costs of smokers, on the costs smokers have to employers, both in productivity and health care costs. A recent New York Times report pegged the annual cost of a smoker to a private employer in the United States at more than $5,800. That same report said that researchers at OSU estimated that the largest cost alone was smoke breaks. How do you measure the value of a smoke break? Everybody gets a break, right?
Right.
Anyway.
So what we did in this study is we looked at the number of smoke breaks that are taken by an average smoker on an average day, and subtracted from that the number of breaks that everyone takes. And what we found was that people who are smoking are taking additional breaks. So that's where that cost comes from. It's the additional time that people who are smoking are away from their job. So it's not just the smoke breaks, but the additional time taken on the smoke breaks.
And what is a smoke break per break? What are you charging us?
That depends, obviously, on who the employee is okay. And how much the employee gets paid. But essentially, we took the average cost that a business is paying an employee, so just the average wage. And actually, we reduced that somewhat to match the average wage of someone who smokes, which is actually lower than the overall average, and then multiplied that by the hours off the job.
Dr. Shields, I guess we can get into now how you came to this decision, how the university came to the decision to expand the ban, and also whether or not the issue of the cost of smoke breaks came into that discussion at all and played a role.
Sure. So first of all, I want to point out that we're not reinventing the wheel here. We're not the first one. There's already 1,100 universities across the country
with
either total bans or smoke-free bans. But we're talking about University of Michigan, University of Kentucky, University of Louisville. The entire University of California system is about to do this, the City University of New York system, Emory, and so on and so on. So looking at their experiences makes it pretty clear that these policies get implemented. They get implemented with a lot of work, but not a lot of protest, and that they're effective and that they actually do change culture within the university. So that's very important. So here, the issue of economics for the employees, in the meetings that I've been in, that's really not been the central focus. It's really, as we talked about, the denormalization of tobacco use, not setting the role models, getting rid of the concept of the sexy smoky bars and that it's cool to smoke. I think that's been foremost on everyone's minds for our students, the students coming in, faculty and staff.
Micah Berman, Does the university community, whether it's Ohio State or whatever community, does it tend to be a big smoking community? Do we have any sense about how it compares to the rest of the world?
On average, students who are in college smoke at a lower rate than students who are not in college, which I think is probably not a surprise and pretty well established. But the Ohio State community obviously has a lot of people on this community from a lot of different backgrounds, so I can't say for the campus as a whole how it compares to other groups.
Dr. Shields, you mentioned earlier when we were off air that you're hoping, one of the hopes is that students considering coming to Ohio State, when they see it's a completely smoke-free campus, that may influence their behavior yet to come.
That's what we hope. I mean, we want to send messages at all levels, both to incoming students. You know, tobacco use and nicotine addiction starts in adolescence and young adults. That's when people believe they can quit at any time until it's too late. We like to try to cut that early and by sending a strong message. But we also want to influence our visitors to campus, our patients. We have had a medical center here, has had a ban now for many years, and it applies to all the patients and the visitors. So we're sending a broad message. People coming to the football stadium will hear that we're tobacco free. It's a very broad message that goes way beyond just our physical.
There is a physical withdrawal from nicotine. To what extent does that come into play as a physician? If you have a patient that's in, for one thing, is a physical withdrawal from nicotine, could it be deleterious? And is there something, is that when you give them the nicotine patches or you help them with?
Well, the withdrawal symptoms are real. They're very uncomfortable. They're not life-threatening. One way that smokers quit is with nicotine replacement therapy to try to avoid those withdrawal symptoms. In fact, though most smokers just quit on their own and they figure out how to deal with the withdrawal symptoms and move on. But part of our policy and plans is to make smoking cessation services even more available. We actually have capacity now. We will increase that as necessary. A lot of the plans for both the employees, faculty, and students include nicotine replacement therapy and other methods. So we're looking at how to increase all of that, assuming that there's an increased demand. In fact, at other universities, demand has not gone up that much, just people quit on their own.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are live at the OSU rally for wellness. If you want to learn more about that, you can go to the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. With me, Professor Micah Berman, joint appointment with the OSU Moritz College of Law and the College of Public Health, and he studies the costs of smoking to employers. Micah Berman, what are the other costs? $3,800 we've nailed, or we've said that the largest cost alone came from the breaks that people take to smoke the cigarettes. What are the other costs?
Right. So that was the largest cost, was the time from smoking breaks. The second largest cost was healthcare costs, which I think a lot of people would have assumed that was the largest piece of the cost. That was also a substantial part of the cost. And then in addition to that, the other big factors that we looked at were increased absenteeism related to smoking, and also what's called presenteeism, which is a lack of focus on the job related to going through the cycle of nicotine withdrawal on a regular basis between smoking breaks.
You mean like the time I forgot how to write a sentence with a verb and a noun when I quit? That kind of thing?
That sort of thing, yes. Okay. It's not just related to quitting, but really the cycle. Every time
every time you stop smoking,
after that nicotine hit wears off, then you start thinking about the next time that you need a smoking break, and you lose concentration because of that.
What about e-cigarettes and chewing tobacco? Are those typically part of these kind of bans, these total bans?
So the short answer is yes. If it's a total ban, then it includes everything, including the electronic cigarettes, which, quite frankly, has been one of the more controversial things, because there are some people who just don't really understand and think that what's the big deal?
It's not hurting anybody else or anybody.
That's the concept. The current data right now is showing that it's really not helping people quit in spite of what it says on the internet. There's also data to show that the nicotine doesn't necessarily come out of the e-cigarettes, so people are buying a product that's not working. But at the end of the day, electronic cigarettes are just another nicotine delivery device like nicotine replacement therapy, and it's a drug, and it should go through the Food and Drug Administration process for approval, just like patches and gum and other things. And if they do, then that would be great. But right now, the e-cig companies, including the major tobacco companies, are looking to get around the FDA process and just put this stuff out on the market. We feel that until there's approval as a nicotine delivery device, we shouldn't be sanctioning it or permitting it in the policy.
I went through a smoking cessation program about 25 or 26 years ago. It wasn't cheap then. They can't be cheap now. Or is it offset of the cost for these smoking cessation programs and AIDS? Micah Berman, are they going to be offset by the savings to the university over the long run?
Sure, I think Dr. Shields could probably talk more about the plans for the university, but certainly for large employers like Ohio State,
right,
an investment in cessation will certainly pay off over the long run, yes.
Yeah.
That's the expectation.
Richard in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Hello. First of all, I think it's because of the evidence of side stream smoking outside is so weak, I'm definitely against the ban. I don't smoke myself. But I also, my question is, what will the sanction be? If someone is smoking, do the smoking police come up and take them downtown? What will the sanction be if people continue to smoke outside?
Well, if you're busted and when you're smoking outside, Dr. Shields?
Okay, so there's two things. Let me speak very briefly to the idea of the side stream smoke. The evidence is flimsy all the time. We make public health decisions on flimsy evidence. For example, we regulate the amount of chemicals in drinking water based on animal studies that we know have little to do with people. But yet the EPA will say that some chemical can't go into the drinking water based on a model in a computer that says it's going to cause one more cancer in a million people. So we do make those public health decisions, and since we don't have the data for the side stream smoke outdoors, I think it's reasonable to include that as a precautionary principle. But that, again, is not our major issue. In terms of the enforcement, there is not plans for smoking police. We expect that, first of all, almost all smokers will just comply with the policy like they comply with all policies. Some people will violate it. We look to processes of education and making sure they're aware. Each unit or part of the university will probably be enforcing things differently. So I will tell you that our medical center has been tobacco-free now for a number of years, and there are policies including violations, caught smoking by the med center security twice, and you could be fired. Okay, but it's going to depend on the individual, the circumstance, what they've...
What about patients?
So obviously we don't fire patients.
Right.
but we do educate them. Every patient who comes into the hospital is offered smoking cessation resources and nicotine replacement therapy or other methods like Chantix and that sort of thing. So it gets tricky, but it's really one of gentle encouragement and education. This is not an enforcement campaign, but an education campaign.
All right, Richard, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it. What about patients who are... psychiatric patients, people who are here for mental health purposes, there's a lot in that routine. There's a lot in that that the act of smoking a cigarette that can be calming. It's not just the nicotine. What about people like that who use it for maybe a little bit different reason?
That's right. That's an important issue. You know, they're patients. They've got mental health illnesses. We have to handle them in our best ways, and maybe we don't do as well as we could sometimes in terms of getting to quit, but these are still dangerous products. And so whether you have a mental health illness or not, it's important not to be exposed to a dangerous product.
So they will be banned as well?
There yes.
Won't be any accommodation made for them?
And let me just emphasize that that's been true since 2006.
Okay.
That's our medical center policy.
Have you had problems with that?
I have not heard of any. I think I would have heard.
Okay.
And in fact, the history among employees is that over several years, some employees have been terminated for repeatedly violating the ban, and that's my understanding, a total number of three since 2006. So again, most people comply with the policies.
Micah Berman, how does a large organization like OSU prepare its managers for symptoms of withdrawal among their employees? Once again, when I quit about 30 years ago, I couldn't write a sentence. And I was a writer for a newspaper. It was a really big problem. How do you...
Well, I think Ohio State is really going out of its way to let employees know about the resources that are available to help people quit. So they're is support for people who are looking for it, and they can pretty easily find that. I think the important part of any campus tobacco-free policy is to just let people know what the policy is, to make people aware of it, to make people aware of the opportunities for help. And then, as we've seen around the country with these policies, if people are aware of the policy, they are going to figure out a way to comply with it.
Okay, and what happens with the January crackdown, Dr. Shields?
Although this is... we're still trying to figure out how to do this, but probably the crackdown will mostly be signage changes and education saying, okay, you know, we're done. We expect you to be tobacco-free as a policy, but we're not, you know, sending out, you know, rogues of university police and that sort of thing. Be strong signage, strong education, toolkits to managers, to student residents, that sort of thing.
I don't want to be one of those people that stops a smoker and tells them that it's against the rules. How many people typically, I don't know if to ask you, Professor Berman or Dr. Shields, you, but how many people typically do citizen enforcement?
Okay, so I don't think we have actual data. I've spoken to people who feel it's very important and some people who say, I just won't do it. There are, you know, videos from other universities that will either use or adopt that will train people how to do that. Our med center actually has little cards that all you have to do is just hand it to the smoker. and say, just for your information, here's a card, and the card says we're a tobacco-free campus, here's where you can get, you know, cessation help and that sort of thing. So it's non-confrontational.
What about campus police? Will they get involved?
So the university police will not get involved. They're viewed as a law enforcement unit, and this is an HR policy, a human resource policy, and they don't enforce policies. Obviously, they will get involved if a smoker becomes belligerent.
Which is what I'm worried about.
Yeah, and so the first thing, of course, is not to put anyone in an unsafe situation. And if there's if you say to a smoker, you know, smoking's not here, and they get angry, then you just say, okay, I'm just letting you know, and just walk away. Simple as that. It's important that we don't get those confrontations. Again, a lot of universities have been through this, mm-hmm. And we know the extent of when issues arrive.
And that type of communication is a lot easier if people are already aware of the policy. So, you know, it's a lot easier to point out the tobacco-free policy if you have signage, if people have heard about it already. So that's why Ohio State is working so hard on this rollout.
Okay. Well, Professor Micah Burma, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Professor Micah Burman, he is with the OSU Moritz College of Law and the College of Public Health here at Ohio State University. We are broadcasting live from the annual OSU Rally for Wellness at the Recreation and Physical Activity Center on campus. WOSU will be here for a couple more hours if you want to drop by. You can check out our website at wosu.org/allsides and get more information that way. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're live at the annual OSU Rally for Wellness at the Recreation and Physical Activity Center on campus. It is very busy here right now, lots to look at. Nearly 100 health and wellness-related exhibitors and professionals offering all sorts of services and information. If you're on campus today, you should check it out. For more information, go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. We're talking about smoking bans today. Next week, Ohio begins its campus-wide ban with the beginning of the next semester. We decided to talk about how the statewide smoking ban has been going in Columbus and how it might inform the folks at OSU. Joining us now is Luke Jacobs of the Environmental Health Division in the Columbus Public Health Department. Welcome to the show, Luke.
Thanks, Ann.
And still with us is Dr. Peter Shields. He's Deputy Director of the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center and co-chair of the tobacco-free implementation team at OSU. Dr. Shields, is the campus-wide ban, is that going to affect in all of the regional campuses as well?
Yes, every one of the regional campuses as well as our extension offices. So we're going to be affecting every county in the state.
Every county in the state.
Correct.
Okay. Luke Jacobs, let's talk about enforcement in Columbus. First of all, it's called the Smoke-Free Workplace Act. Sure. In the state of Ohio. The idea is to protect people in their workplace, including restaurants and bars and so forth. How well does it work?
It works really well. You know, I think initially there was some heartburn that was caused in 2007 when it was passed, but Columbus is really unique in that we had a local smoking ban before the statewide ban.
Right.
So as opposed to other big cities in the state that may have seen a big boom in 2007 for complaints, we've stayed relatively static. And, I mean, the way that we know that it works is that we get very few fines and violation notices given out every year. For the most part, every time we go into a facility, we don't see violations of the Smoke-Free Workplace Act. So that leads us to believe that, for the most part, it's self-policing, as has been spoken to earlier, and that it works.
How many at the beginning, the statewide ban went into effect in 2006 and the city ban went into effect in, wasn't it 2004?
Four, yep.
How many complaints did the city health department get at the outset?
You know, I don't have that data in front of me, but I can tell you that as typical with these kind of bans, it's a culture change. So there's going to be a lot of resistance. There's going to be a heavy amount of again, heartburn being caused by this and people not wanting to comply. But for the most part, after a big boom, it kind of polices itself, and establishments know that you know, once a few fines get issued, that, you know, we mean business and that we're going to go out and we're going to do the enforcement arm of making sure that we keep places healthy and safe and by eliminating secondhand smoke.
Now, the Supreme Court, the Ohio Supreme Court, has resolved a question that started with a local bar in Columbus, went all the way, and they found for the state.
Sure.
In enforcing the ban. Are there pockets of resistance?
Sure. I think as with any set of regulations or rules, there are going to be facilities that feel that it's not right, feel that the government has no right to infringe upon their business, or they feel like their business is being infringed upon. But, you know, for the most part, again, I mean, the law works, the rules work. I mean, people, establishments know that smoking is not allowed in their establishments. And so, are there pockets? Sure. I mean, do we still have to fine people? Absolutely. But for the most part, that number has dropped off to a very minuscule amount.
Dr. Peter Shields, are you worried? It was brought up earlier about the kind of the demoralization of smokers making humiliation of this total ban. What about the idea of the idea of that?
Well, I think it's important for people to realize that nicotine is an extremely addictive drug. It's probably the most addictive drug we have. Most smokers have started when they were adolescents and young adults, as I've mentioned. So this is something that we have to deal with, I think, respectfully and with that understanding. But there are some people who just feel like, oh, well, they're stupid because they're smoking. And that is just not the case.
It's kind of interesting. So far, the people who have called have been, of our listeners, have been non-smokers defending the right of smokers to smoke, at least outdoors.
Well, we all understand individual rights. As I mentioned before, from a public health perspective, we sometimes have to restrict rights. We restrict speech, such as yelling fire in a theater. We make people wear seatbelts. We do make people wear helmets when they're riding motorcycles.
In Ohio.
For the first year. Okay. When your first year, you're licensed in Ohio. Other states do more. And I know those facts,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, there are times that we do that. And tobacco just takes so many lives. I mean, I take care of lung cancer patients, and patient after patient are smokers who are looking back on their lives of smoking and realizing that it just wasn't worth it.
Mort in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. I think you have a question for Dr. Shields.
Yes. First of all, let me say I stopped smoking 40 years ago, and I'm strongly against it. But I wonder if in trying to address the arguments against smoking, they're overlooking one benefit to the smokers that keeps them going, and that is the tendency of smoking to keep them more alert.
So that's an excellent point. There's a reason why people continue to smoke or use nicotine. There's in fact a lot of benefits from it because it does make you sharper, keeps you more awake, it reduces hunger. There's a reason why, you know, during World War II, the military commanders loved their soldiers to be smoking. It's the perfect thing. It reduces depression. And so all of that stuff's important, but I think is very, very tiny compared to the harmful effects of everything else that's in a cigarette.
Okay. Mort, thanks for your call. Scott in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Hi. Just a couple of brief comments, and then I'll listen off the air. First of all, I support protecting people against secondhand smoke. But these kind of area-wide bans and things are, I think, not the way to do that. And the whole notion that it's protecting public health by getting individuals to stop smoking is just absurd. It doesn't have that effect. It happens to be politically in right now, so it's a good time to do it. However, things like the claim that it makes people less productive is a bit of a red herring, because as someone who used to be a smoker in an office where I went outside to smoke, I can tell you that the fact that you've gone outside to smoke in no way means that you have stopped working. There are many, many instances where you continue to work during that period of time. You're just not at your desk doing it. And I will take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Dr. Shields.
So obviously it's going to depend on the occupation. If you're a nurse, you can't work outside. You got to work with your patients. In terms of the effectiveness of these bans, I think we'll just have to agree to disagree. We know that in tobacco control, every nudge we give to someone who's contemplating to quit helps them quit. And there's always less smokers when you implement these things. And I think the data is good for that.
As far as the Ohio Department of Health has quitline benefits, free counseling and nicotine replacement therapy, those kind of things. But all of it's for low-income people. Is that the case for the city, too? Because lots of people don't fall into the income category that would qualify for them for that, but they also cannot afford the counseling or the therapies and that sort of thing. Luke Jacobs of the City Health Department?
Sure. So I think in general, people would have to check with their insurance companies as far as what cessation programs, if any, they may offer. But from a cost standpoint, and just doing the math, if you smoke a pack of cigarettes, if you're using nicotine replacement therapy and you smoke a pack of cigarettes a day, well, you're looking at spending roughly $150 a month on tobacco at a minimum. And I would advocate that replacement therapy, depending on what brand you get, would be a little cheaper than that. So it's a little more out-of-pocket costs up front, but in the long run, again, from a cost standpoint, you'd be spending less money on a monthly basis on replacement therapy than you would be for, to buy cigarettes.
Dr. Shields, did you talk about having smoking areas like some kind of corral somewhere? Did that come up in the course of conversation about the ban?
We did. We carefully considered that. There are some institutions such as Emory that started that way. And we decided that that's just delaying where we need to be, which is promoting the healthy culture. Either way, the smokers are going to need to figure out how to adapt. And so by having a area, it's sort of like us saying to them, you know what, this is okay for some time. And we thought it was just better that since they have to learn how to adapt, now is better than the future.
In a lot of places where smoking is already banned at a facility, whether it's a company or whatever it is, people go to the just off the grounds of that facility and they smoke there, which is allowed, and then they drop their cigarette butts and the cigarette butts pile up. And I know that was a problem downtown. What about that? Was that considered? Has it been a problem around the city first, Luke Jacobs? I've seen piles of cigarette butts in different areas.
Sure, it's kind of a catch-22. The grocery store that puts the ashtray right out in front of it, you could have migration of smoke, which is against the law. So, companies have to struggle with that fact, and certainly cigarette butts are just like any other waste that doesn't degrade quickly. So, absolutely, it's a problem that we've seen on campuses that have, gone smoke-free.
So we are directly addressing the issue in different ways. We know that around the med center that's been tobacco-free, that there have been problems in the community, and not just the cigarette butts, but loitering, mm-hmm. having to smell the smoke, noise issues, and that's all there. So we're working with a number of different neighborhood associations as well as the city. We're thinking about helping them with specific signage that will say things like Ohio State University is tobacco-free. We support their policies. We've had discussions for even contributing to costs of cleaning butts and that sort of thing. And all this stuff we're working with right now, but our neighbors are obviously important and part of us, and we all have to do this together.
Will the smoking cessation benefits extend to students as well?
So the student, it's not all students, but most students have already access to nicotine replacement therapy and smoking cessation counseling. I think all of them have access to smoking cessation counseling and most of the NRT.
And insurance benefits cover?
I think it's either insurance benefits or they just get it through student health. I don't know those details.
Well, the ceremonial ban begins next week. You're going to start educating students. It goes into full effect in January.
Correct.
Maybe we'll check back with you and see how it's going then.
That'd be great.
All right. Dr. Peter Shields, he's Deputy Director of the OSU Comprehensive Cancer Center and co-chair of the Tobacco-Free Implementation Team at OSU. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. This
and
was great.
Luke Jacobs, thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks, Ann. Always a pleasure.
Luke Jacobs is Section Chief at the Environmental Health Division of the Columbus Public Health Department. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're broadcasting live from the annual OSU Rally for Wellness at the Recreation and Physical Activity Center on the OSU campus. Thanks for listening.